This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I think there's a strand of American identity that's always been there that's very connected to this notion of liberty as the right to protect oneself against any and all, who, including the government, when it departs from our perceived, you know, perception of what it should be doing, what it's up to. I think there's just a broad, there's a deep, I don't know how broad it is, but there's a deep belief that's held closely in American, certain strands, certain pockets of America, that justice is what we say it is. And as long as it's advancing the interests of the community to which I identify, it's justice.
Mover Nation, wherever you may be and however you may be listening or watching, thanks for making me a part of your day. So today I am speaking with the creative duo behind Orbit Media's brand new podcast, The Burden, which is one of this year's most anticipated true crime podcasts following their previous number one hit, Empire on Blood. Let's take a listen to the trailer and check it out.
Louis Scarsella was the greatest homicide detective of his generation.
I am the protector of these people. I am the guardian that they need.
Derek Hamilton was the best jailhouse lawyer of his.
And the lawyer was my girlfriend. It was all I had.
What happens when a group of convicted felons take on the cop who put them away?
We gotta attack Scarsella.
Come and get me.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The podcast is hosted by award-winning investigative journalist Steve Fishman, who is renowned for getting Bernie Madoff to confide in him, along with lawyer, author, and award-winning journalist Dax Devlin Ross. I'm Collier Landry. Let's get into it.
Testimony continued today in the most notorious criminal trial in...
When I was 12 years old, my testimony sent my father to prison for murdering my mother. I decided at an early age that our trauma should not be what defines us. It's what we choose to do with it that does. I'm here to share my unique perspective on true crime, mental health, society, and popular culture, albeit with a slight sense of humor. I'm Collier Landry, and welcome to my show. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining the program. You have an exciting new podcast, The Burden, out on Orbit Media. You just got a big feature on Apple. And why don't you tell my audience who you are and about the story of The Burden?
First of all, thanks so much for having us on the show. It means a whole lot for you to just take some time to learn a little bit about what we're up to and what this story is attempting to do in the world. And it is a big day for us with Apple identifying it as a new and noteworthy, which is an accomplishment in and of itself. But my name is Dax Devlin Ross, and I'm one of the co-hosts of this series, The Burden, that I will turn it over to my esteemed co-host to say a bit more about.
Dax, stop bragging. Well, I'm going to introduce Dax then. So he is also a co-founder of Orbit and really one of the engines of The Burden. We've been doing this for several years
now. Don't say it.
No, I'm going with several years. That's all. People can do what they want with that. You know, Dax had two babies. I had a baby during the time. Dax is a lawyer by training. He's got the certificate, but disappointed his parents and became an investigative journalist. And he's just been a true companion and partner on this. We've been on this for a while. I'm come from the publishing world. I was a staff writer at New York Magazine for a long time and doing a lot of true crime, which I would not have said was my specialty. But when I look back, there's a lot of it. Jumped to podcasts at about the right time and did a first one on Madoff called Ponzi Supernova, based on him calling me from prison and us becoming kind of buddies. And the next one was Empire on Blood, which I was very fortunate, became number one on Apple, and option to be a TV show. Of course, we'll see about that. This show is in many ways a kind of extension of that. We, in Empire on Blood, it was very much, I entered the story through the point of view of a wrongfully convicted person, and was always really interested in what the hell these cops were thinking, right? I mean, are we talking about guys who are malicious? Are we talking about guys who are incompetent? And so we decided to focus on the once most famous, now most infamous cop in his time, in the last 30 years, 80s and 90s, Detective Louis Scarcella is a guy who puts away the worst criminals, gets the confessions no one else could get. Fast forward 30 years and 20 people that he helped convict have had their convictions overturned. And I think what Dax and I discovered along the way is, you know, that's a fascinating story. And one of the things we'll eventually tell you is how we got to Scarcella, because he was a no comment guy for the past 10 years. But the other thing we discovered along the way, and which I believe is kind of gives this soul and heart, is that there is this jailhouse law firm, a law firm formed in prison of convicted murderers, none of whom graduated high school, all of whom claimed innocence, and three of whom discover that they have Scarcella in their case. So they make a vow, we got to get at this guy. And I don't want to give away anything, but they are extremely effective in carrying out their vow. And so you have this kind of clash of this great detective and these jailhouse lawyers who are out to get him. I'll stop there.
Was he really a great detective that you ended up finding out, or was it just he was great at assisting to convict people who were innocent of crimes?
I'll start on that. He was a great detective. I mean, he was extremely effective. You know, he arrested lots of bad guys and put lots of criminals away. There's just no doubt about that. Did he cross the line? Did he follow regulations? Did he think that he understood justice maybe better than the rules? Definitely. You know, here's a guy who, you know, he told Dax and I some stories about, well, the one that we opened the podcast with is, you know, it's his lunch break at, he's appearing in court. It's a lunch break. And he goes to confront a murder suspect, sees him coming out of his apartment or house, runs up on him. The guy's got a rifle in his belt, I guess a sawed-off shotgun kind of thing. So Scarcella leaps on him, puts his Glock to the suspect's head and pulls the trigger, as he tells us. Now, the gun does not go off. But I remember asking him, did you ever imagine that gun went off? And he said, of course, I wanted it to go off. What did you want me to do, kiss him? So this was a certain kind of cop. Now, could things go wrong? Could a cop like that maybe, you know, want to get a guy that he was convinced was a bad guy by any means necessary? I don't know. I'd be interested. Dax, weigh in, but I think we got to say distinct possibility.
You know, I really sit with the word great, and I think it's important. I mean, in 2024, our definition of what a great detective is very, very different than what it was in 1984. And that's largely a function of advances in technology, forensic science, and what we come to expect of the kind of work that a detective does. I think what's striking to me is how radically different what the policing landscape is relative to what it was when he was policing in New York City 30, 40 years ago, up until he retired in the earlier 2000s. I mean, you're talking about someone who was, his work was largely taking place at a time when there were no forensics that you could use to track DNA. There was no expectation or requirement that if you were to try to seek a conviction, you needed to have more than one witness. You didn't need to necessarily even find the smoking gun, so to speak, necessarily to have a very convincing and compelling case that could lead to a conviction. The bar was lower. The bar was lower. And I think, would he be considered a great detective today by today's standards had he not really continued to develop, his skill set, if you will? No. For the times, and this is a big thing that we actually haggled over in our writing of the script.
What time period was this? You mentioned the 80s. So give us some context.
He's policing through the 70s, through the 80s, through the, he resigns and retires, I'd say, was it late 90s?
2000, yeah. 1999, 2000.
So you're talking about, a significant period of time, but this is still fairly modern in terms of when he actually leaves the force. And then, he's retired for over a decade when his past comes back to haunt him. I mean, this is a guy who had gone off into the sunset. He'd gone off to live a very different life and was highly celebrated, had, as he tells us, three rooms full of commendations and awards that he ultimately threw away into a dumpster pile because he was so disgraced and disgusted with what had happened to his life. But again, this question of greatness is actually the thing that we're exploring, because there are people who do believe deeply and hold steadfast to the notion of him being an exceptional detective. I think I would end by saying that what I would not question about him is that he dedicated himself to what he perceived was a pursuit of justice. He had what I would consider to be a flawed sense of his role in society. He believed that he was the savior of the community that he was policing. He was there to protect people. He uses these words very bluntly without any kind of, deep reflection on the implications of defining himself as a savior in a particularly Black community where he's working. But I think I don't question and impugn his work ethic. I don't think he intentionally went around not trying to do decent police work. I think he was overwhelmed. I think he was in many ways underskilled. And I think that in many ways the landscape changed and how we evaluate him is very different because of the work that a lot of these jailhouse lawyers did to make it very apparent that we got to look closer. We got to ask more questions. And that wasn't happening, quite frankly, during his heyday.
Collier, the one thing that I want to add to that is that the landscape of the city was so different back then. It's hard to imagine. In fact, people who weren't around then can't believe when people who were around describe it. So there were over 2,000 murders a year. There were 7 bodies falling. There were weekends when there were 50 people shot. And there was a famous headline in the New York Post, Dave Do Something. Dave then being David Dinkins, the first Black mayor of New York City. And David Dinkins comes in. He's a reformer. He wants to fund social programs. He has an idea about how you build a society that's better for everybody. And he converts and says, I will do anything necessary to stem the tide of crime. And what he does is he hires 1,000 new cops and puts them on the streets. And so you have to, I think, put your back in that headspace and say, these are cops who were sent out on a mission and told to take back the city by any means necessary. And certainly Louis Scarcella signed up for that with enthusiasm. But the point that I want to make about this is, we love the idea of a rogue cop, one guy doing bad. But first of all, it wasn't the show run by one detective with a 9th grade education and no training to be a detective. There's a lot of powers that be, especially in the district attorney's office, who are really running the show. But the other thing to really think about is that the responsibility of people like us, we're voters. We knew what was going on. We hated crime. We told the politicians, get something done, and we were not particularly worried about how it was done. You know, the guy's a crack dealer. Get him off the streets. Yeah, maybe he did that murder. He definitely did that murder. You know, the guy has a previous arrest for armed robbery. We don't need him on the streets. So, you know, it's an era when we are all, in a sense, kind of partners in this. And then fast forward 30 years, and now we're really looking at how these things were done. And, you know, we're doing it from our sushi bars and our dog runs, which the cops will tell you, you know, hey, we made those possible. And we did it on $30,000 a year. Yeah. So, hey, fuck off. That's what they're thinking.
Yeah.
So this was pre, like, the Giuliani cleanup. Because wasn't Rudy Giuliani elected mayor in New York City in but the 80s to clean up, like, organized crime? And he did that. That's why they called him America's mayor, right? I mean, things, my times have changed, but... Mm-hmm. Was this part of like that pre-Giuliani and then Giuliana era of just by any means necessary?
Yeah, I think it was. So Dinkins is defeated by Giuliani and largely on the premise and the specific campaign plank that I'm the sheriff, meaning Giuliani says, I'm the sheriff. I'm going to take care of this. And, you know, there's a lot of dog whistling. You know, there's a lot of, we got to take care of those people. But I'll also say, if you go back and you look at the news footage, you know, liberal pundits on TV are saying, I want more prisons. I want these kids. And it was an era when teenagers were first prosecuted as adults because of what was going on. I want these kids locked up and put away for a long time. So you started actually with the Dinkins era. It then becomes kind of full blown with Giuliani, who kind of takes another step.
Yeah. I think Steve just hit something that's really was a real appeal and draw to me, which is, you know, the men who comprise the jailhouse lawyers, the attorneys that are featured heavily in this story. These guys were 18, 19, 20 years old when they were locked up. I mean, these were young guys. And part of the reckoning that we have to confront right now is that these are now men in their 50s, you know? And I, like said very early on, it's in many ways, these guys represent a lost generation. I mean, they are the people who went away to prison before we started a whole conversation in our nation around mass incarceration. There was no sympathy. There was no sort of broad, like, populist or popular movement to address wrongful convictions. None of that existed. And so they exist as a kind of referendum on all of us to think about, what does it mean when we get, to Steve's point, when we get caught up in these moments where we think that we're feeling a level of chaos or uncertainty, and that we're looking to the very people that will villainize the next moment, those being the police, to take care of things for us. Like, we want, and part of, you know, when we think about when Steve and I really started to work on the story, when I joined the story in particular, was summer 2020. And you remember summer 2020. Remember the protests in the street, the defund the police. Part of what appealed to me was that I, as someone who'd been doing investigative reporting and has, you know, been thinking a lot about crime and policing and jails, and it was striking to me how many people were all of a sudden adamantly opposed to any form of policing. And I wasn't condemnatory to it, but I wanted to remind us that, you know, let's be clear, like, we shift very easily when this, you know, when the tides can change and when our sense of our own safety is at risk. We can very easily become those very people who sat on those juries and without very much meaningful evidence and sometimes very incredible witnesses said convict. And I just want us to, like, I was one of the people, I wanted us to be cognizant of that. It's important to have a critique of policing, but also it's important to look in the mirror and have a critique of ourselves and ask, to the point Steve just made a moment ago, like, we're also a part of this apparatus. It's very nice to blame Louis Scarcella and say he's the rogue and he did it all. But there's an entire apparatus that includes Joe Citizen and Jane Citizen and everybody else have to be complicit in this to some extent for it to happen.
That's a fantastic point, and I think something that gets lost in the conversation a lot. Were most of these men that Louis Scarsella went after, were they people of color, or did it not matter? Were the people that were tied to organized crime? Were they, as Steve was saying earlier, crack dealers and things, you know, drug dealers, petty theft, burglary? I mean, what was the nature of their crimes that they were ultimately convicted for?
Well, you know, one of the things that's interesting here, you mentioned organized crime. So Detective Scarsella was not an organized crime investigator, but we spent a lot of time with him. And I want to mention that he was not speaking to anybody else, but for the burden, we stalked him and went to his favorite Russian bathhouse and jumped in the freezing Atlantic Ocean, passed the test, a proof of our determination. And he really wanted to tell his story. And I think Dax and I both agree that he was very open and, well, you make your own decision about his honesty, but forthright, I would say. You know, he didn't duck
emotive
questions.
Too. Quite emotive. Very emotive. Yeah,
meaning he was crying constantly, but that's because...
Why was he crying? Was he crying out of remorse for what he had done?
Great
or
question.
Crying out of passion that he did the best he could?
I think it was really, he's an emotional guy. He would say, I'm Italian. And so he cries a considerable amount, not afraid of his emotions, or at least that emotion. And he, at the same time, he is deeply hurt by his fall from grace, deeply. And, you know, some of the most, I think, really compelling moments or moments that kind of got me maybe where he said, listen, his downfall started about 10 years ago. And he said, the last 10 years of my life have just been a waste. I had a lot of good in me. I could have done some good. And so to kind of be condemned to this exile when he was, and somebody called him the Prince of the City, he felt just constantly hurt. He was ostracized by the community, by the press, and by his own cohort. You know, a lot of cops who supported him would not speak out for fear. His own community, he tells this story, couldn't get a job as a janitor at his local community pool because of the bad publicity that was threatened. So, I don't want to overemphasize the ways in which we, kind of empathized with him. But I think, and Dax can weigh in on this, but, you know, journalism is in part an exercise in empathy and putting yourself in someone else's shoes. And we tried to do that with Scarsella. And I think we also did that with the people who were in the jailhouse law firm. And that's a very interesting and different path. These were, by and large, people who had been in trouble. Derek Hamilton is kind of the leader, certainly the intellectual leader of the jailhouse law firm. And he's a guy who shot people. He told us that. He shot people before, you know. He did a lot of things that, as he put it, hurt a lot of families. But to Dax's point, he goes away when he's 17 or 18 years old. So who was he really? And what he has kind of remarkably done is he's become this elite legal figure who is now a deputy director of an elite program at a law school. So his trajectory, no one would have suspected. And I think it raises the question of what do we think of putting people away at age 18 or 19 and essentially throwing away the key? I mean, do we really believe that people aren't redeemable, that there's not potential, that we're... And this goes, and I'd love to have Dax weigh in on this, because you have a series of cops who are white cops, Italian cops, people who come from a different community, going to a black community that in many ways, I don't think they understand the dynamics of, and can they go in and say, this is just a bad kid. This is just a kid who made some bad decisions and completely talented in other ways. And I throw it over to Dax, and Dax, maybe you want to talk about the comparison with, you know, Nicky Black and how Louis.
There was something you said earlier, Steve, and I want to come back to the point that you just asked about when you raised about Nicky Black, and we'll get to Nicky Black. But a real struggle that I had entering this story was creating enough emotional distance to be able to evaluate Louis Scarsella in a manner that wasn't completely tied to my own perceptions of policing, law enforcement, and what I had read in the headlines about him. That was very challenging. The good news about it taking us almost 4 years to do this was that my own, it allowed for me to grow. And a lot of, not necessarily grow to like think he's a great person, but by no stretch that way, but to grow as a journalist and to grow as a person who is able to evaluate in different from different perspectives. And I credit Steve with that as well, and our journey together on in that regard. I think when I first encounter Louis Scarsella, I have a hard time getting past the language he uses to characterize his work and the sort of contradiction, I would say, like what I perceived a level of hypocrisy, which was that you go into communities, Black communities, you kick in doors, you run through the neighborhood, drive fast, you do all this stuff, but I bet you would never do that in your own community. You would never go back in your community where there is crime, considerable crime, crime that is in your own family, you would not police with this kind of abandon, that kind of cowboy mentality, right? So to Steve's point, like, there's a question that I think just we have to deal with and contend with in the way we've decided, you know, to staff police forces all over this country, which is that we don't require them to live in the communities they police. And there may be some good reasons for that. There may be safety precautions and whatever else have you. But nevertheless, it creates, I think, a wall and a challenge to navigate when you are entering an environment that is not one that you experience in any other condition other than as a police officer. You're not a regular civilian in that neighborhood going to the grocery store. You're not taking your children to that school, into the community. You're only there in the context and in the capacity of policing. What does that do to you? Do you have a level of compassion and a level of empathy for the community that you would then have for your own community? And I don't know if I see that enough. I don't know if I see that. So as it relates to the actual situation with Louis Scarsella, his uncle, I think this was the more mind-blowing and fascinating elements of the story, was that the uncle that he heroizes, he idolizes, Nicky Black, was, you know, a ranking member of a crime family. He knows this his entire life. This is not some information that he is, you know, not privy to. He is aware of this. And in many ways, he is enamored by it. And the thing that I struggle with, and I think listeners will wrestle with and have in their own ways be able to contend with, is the language he uses to create a level of exceptionalism for his uncle's criminality. There's honor he talks about. There's a certain honor in that crime, the crime that happens in an organized crime situation relative to these street thugs. So the Derek Hamiltons of the world, the Chewbacca Shakurs of the world, any of the people that we encounter in this story, there's no way, shape, and form that they could also have a logic or an honor or a code. There's a wild, and that is racialized. That is racialized. So that, I think, is a challenge that he doesn't, even if we bring it to his attention, I don't know if he's able to really reconcile how he's able to perceive honor in one context and perceive only sort of form of like barbarism and chaos, chaotic behavior, when these are similar crimes, just happening in different ethnic enclaves, if you will.
One of the things that Nicky Black does, so Nicky Black, who's Black is his nickname because his hair was so black, but his name's Nicky Grancio. So he's, as Dax said, made member of the Colombo crime family. And he is the main suspect in a murder, and this is crazy but true, that his nephew, Detective Louis Scarsella, is assigned to investigate. So Louis Scarsella is assigned to investigate his uncle, right? Wow. And he goes and he interviews his uncle and maybe he asks him if he did it, but he ends up thinking, I couldn't get him, but did he do it? Yeah, he did it. He killed this kid, right? This 22-year-old kid who happened to be dealing drugs in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. So that's a different neighborhood. The point being here that he adored his uncle. Louis Scarsella adored his uncle and called him, as Dak said, the most honorable man he'd ever met. This despite the fact that he also said, yeah, he's a murderer. Okay, he's a murderer. You happy I said that? Yeah, I'm happy he said that. He's a murderer. So to kind of have these two things, as Dax has spoken to, is really extraordinary. Now, the other thing that happens...
it's almost like cognitive dissonance in a lot of ways. Yeah. You know, just him, you talk about him crying and emoting and being very emotive. When you have all this going on in your head... Yeah. You're constantly fighting with yourself. Of course, that's going to reflect in how he behaves when you interview him, for sure.
Yeah.
And also kind of throw into it this mix that Detective Scarsella believes he knows what justice is. And, you know, maybe we all do it to some extent. But I'll give you the example that kind of pops out to me from our reporting in The Burden. He is trying to find out if his uncle did this. The murdered victim is a 22-year-old sometime drug dealer. And the story is that this drug dealer has hooked Nikki Black's daughter on drugs. So Scarsella and I are at a diner one day, and Scarsella says to me, well, how would you feel if this guy hooked your kid on drugs? You know, and that's an interesting question, because crime, we talk about it as statistics, we talk about it as sociological, but it's also very personal, right? Mm-hmm. Especially when it hits home, right? Mm-hmm. So sure. Scarsella is somebody who does put us before that choice, which is interesting. My answer to him was, I'd want to kill him, but it's not in my blood. And Scarsella said, in effect, I think I'd kill him and just turn myself in. And he said, then he added, these are what we call public service murders. Mm-hmm. So the killing of a 22-year-old drug dealer who was ruining the neighborhood, which happened to be Scarsella's neighborhood, was a public service murder. It's listen, make of it what you will. You know, it's a really interesting formulation.
Do you think that has changed any in, 30 years since that happened? That sort of mentality in the police forces? And, you know, when we talk about modern policing, it's a very interesting way to put that, a public service murder. You know, there are a lot of people, call it Texas justice or what have you, but like to take the law into their own hands. Yeah. We've seen a lot of that lately.
Yeah. Stand your ground.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. You know, do you think that has changed?
I would suggest, honestly, that this country is revealing more and more of that ethos. I think that ethos is presenting itself in voter maps. It's presenting itself in, you know, the reason and rationale behind our choices people are making relative to who they want to vote for. I think there's a strand of American identity that's always been there, that's very connected to this notion of liberty as the right to protect oneself against any and all who, including the government, and we're talking about January 2021, including the government, sure, when it departs from our perceived you know, perception of what it should be doing and what it's up to. I think there's just a broad, there's a deep, I don't know how broad it is, but there's a deep belief that's held closely in American, certain strands, certain pockets of America, that justice is what we say it is. And as long as it's advancing the interests of the community to which I identify, it's justice. And I don't need an external force to define that for me. I get to define it. And it's part of like the frontier mentality. That's a frontier mentality that continues to live and find pockets of vitality in our society. And I can't divine the thinking of, you know, the current police force. And again, like, I hope people don't register this podcast as being anti-cop or about trying to, you know, I think we're trying to present a balanced story that is highly problematic. But I do have, as a person in my body and of the community that I connect with, the communities I connect with, I have to contend with just what I observe is that there is an attitude, an idea of justice that is taken into one's hands and do what one believes one should do to maintain, protect, or advance one's interests.
You know, I guess what I'll add to that is, it's really interesting because one of the things we really tried to do, and I think we were successful to some extent, you always want to be more successful, but really to put this in the context, not only of the times, but of the justice system, because Louis Scarcella, in the hierarchy of the justice system, he's an essential, but not completely consequential actor. So he brings his evidence to the district attorney's office, which decides whether to arrest somebody. District attorney decides what witnesses to put on the stand, right? We, through our one of our featured characters, exposed this quite unbelievable, seemingly unbelievable post on an obscure blog on the internet by one of the assistant district attorneys. It's in a cigar forum of all places. And the question asked is, what are the circumstances for the greatest cigar you ever smoked? And this assistant district attorney says, well, it was given to me by this legendary detective, Louis Scarcella. And he was the detective on the first two cases that I prosecuted. And they were two cases with the same witness, who was turned out to be Scarcella's go-to witness, who we actually found claimed to see 11 different murders. She was an unfortunate person in many ways. She was addicted to crack. She was at least a part-time sex worker. She lived in an extremely dangerous neighborhood. So there was a lot of violence going on. No question she could have seen a lot of murders. 11 murders kind of strains credulity, as they say. But the important point here is that this detective brings this witness to the assistant district attorney, and it's his decision to put her on the stand in not one, but in two cases where she says she saw the same guy commit two different murders. And he, in this blog post, says, essentially, anyone believing in the credibility of this witness should get their head examined, right? And eventually, the district attorney looks at this and says, this woman is totally lacking in credibility. And guess what? We're overturning all the convictions she helped get. But this assistant attorney puts her on the stand in two cases, gets one conviction, and is now a judge.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So let's flip this a little bit. You know, we've talked enough about Scarcella. What about Derek Hamilton and this jailhouse law firm? And how did these guys rally? I think a lot of people, you know, I've spent way more time in prison than any free man should that isn't attached to law enforcement or a convicted criminal. And I've seen a lot of people, including my father, who is guilty 100% of murdering my mother. I heard it happen. So I know that I can rest with absolute certainty. But He's even right now fighting for not only an appeal, but he's going to be up for parole again, and but also lots of technicalities. But just my experience over almost now 3 decades of dealing with him is that inmates will take up their cases and learn so much, all the nuances of the law. And that to me is such an incredible feat, because many of these, you said, they're children essentially when they're incarcerated, and they don't have the skills. They don't have a college education. They probably don't have much of an education to begin with. Some of them can't read. They learn how to read in prison, and then they learn how to do all this. Talk to me about the extraordinary conviction that they held to get justice for themselves and their families. What does that look like?
First of all, like, I just got to sit with, and, you know, I had not know that about your story. Did not know that.
They didn't tell you that part.
No,
that's heavy duty, man. But it helps give some context for why you do the work you do. And I can imagine just even, you know, your father trying to win an appeal or whatever it is that can produce a number of myriad emotions for you. I wanted to just hold that.
Sure.
As far as, and I know Steve will have a lot to say this as well, about this as well. Conviction is absolutely a word to use to describe these guys. Like, there is an undeniable amount of, and distinctly about Derek Hamilton and Shabaka Shakur. These are not your garden variety jailhouse lawyers. Like, these are two guys who are exceptionally, like, if you sit down with them and understand their ability to put together and understand their case, and not only understand their own cases, understand the other members of the AI team's cases, you will understand that these are legal minds. These are legal, not, if you were to call them savants, folks who could have been and should have been actually lawyers, judges, whatever you, that's, so they are, there's a needle in a haystack component here too. Like, they're, and the fact, and that's what makes it so remarkable, is that they found each other. And they weren't just operating in, they were for a long time in periods of their jail sentences operating in isolation. They weren't always in the same prison. There was a point in time when they—
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Were they all remarkably incarcerated together, and they're sitting at the lunch table and they're like, hey, so who put you away? Oh, Scarcell, me
you're
too.
You kind of said it. I mean, it's a fascinating story when, you know, Shabaka's already at Auburn Correctional, and he's not the only one there. There's a couple of members of the team that are there at this point. But when Derek arrives at this point, when Derek arrives at Auburn, as you can imagine, people might be moved around from one prison to another over a period of time. Word spreads, because at this point, Derek has made a reputation for himself. He's litigated, he's filed every grievance you can imagine under the book, and he's won a remarkable number of them. And what I think Shabaka and Danny and a couple and Nelson, what they understand is that Derek's arrival at their prison is a unique moment and a unique opportunity. So they set about, you basically articulated it. They set about finding him and recruiting him to be their ostensible leader of their clinic that they form, and they literally meet on a daily basis.
That's wild. How many men are we talking about, by the way?
There's an extended family of them, and they had a very rigorous screening process. So they had a very rigorous screening process. Like, you couldn't just get in the AI team. They actually were going to call your bluff if they believed that you actually did not have a claim and you actually were legitimately guilty of your crime. You couldn't That's be wild. Down with them. That's and that was wild. Because they had to make sure there was a certain purity in what they were doing, because perception is, you know,
absolutely,
whatever percentage of reality.
Can't have any weevils in the flower, you know?
It would undermine what they were up to. And so they would put people through rigorous examination of the extent to which they understood their own case, but also they would look at their cases and they would be able to point out if there were actual inconsistencies and flaws that could not be explained, then that was probably a red flag of something more. That isn't to say they wouldn't care about these guys, or they might try to help them in the ways that they might be able to. But that inner circle had to remain pretty tight. And Steve, I'd say what we had a core four, you know? Was that a core four?
Yeah. And to your point, Collier, they're sitting at the law library, which was their, you know, office one day. And Shabaka, each of them wrote his own motion. So Chewbacca asks Dirk, hey, read my motion. I want to see what you think. Give me a critique. Derek reads the motion and he looks at Chewbacca and says, damn, Scarcella was the cop in your case? He was the cop in my case too. Oh, and wow. We interviewed a lawyer who's very involved in this movement. And he said, that moment changed the course of New York legal history. I think that's true. Chewbacca is a big brain. Derek's a big brain who's really dedicated to the law, as he told us. I love the law. I had to love the law. It was my only way to freedom.
His girlfriend. And
he called girlfriend, his girlfriend, right? Right. It was my girlfriend. It's my only way to freedom. So these guys are deeply invested, and they put these brains to work at it. And you know, I think the background to this, and you know this, Collier, but who knows how many of the listeners and viewers do, is that these people in jail, they are the least privileged people in America. I mean, they are licking their own stamps. You know, they are sending letters to the court. They get on the phone and they'll do anything to try and get a response, because those things disappear in judges' chambers. So Derek, for instance, would call the judges' chambers and say, I'm calling from the Daily News. I want to know what's happening with this case. And anything to prod and provoke. Incredibly kind of genius. But imagine like running your defense from a prison payphone. You know,
it's incredible. And, you know, I talk a lot about on the program when I'm sort of, you know, I try not to dwell on true crime, but just my experience of, you know, from over the decades of visiting my father in prison, again, who's rightfully there, but prison is awful. Like, it is not a nice place. And I'm always stunned at when perpetrators think that they're above the law, much like my father did, you know, or they just think they can get away with something and they don't think about the consequences of life stops. You know what I mean? And you don't have any freedom whatsoever. And you're in a very violent situation where other people don't have it. And there's overcrowding as well that we're dealing with now. So the opportunities that that befall inmates to do what these guys did is, like you said, needle in a haystack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Collier, I got to ask you, do you want your dad to get parole?
Look, my father will be incarcerated for almost 35 years. You know, he'll be 81 in less than a month. So I don't, that's an interesting question. You think about how the world has changed since 1990, right? Mm-hmm. That is we live on these devices, you know what I mean? And I think about just the way the world has changed. I almost, you know, it takes me back to Shawshank Redemption, which is ironically filmed in my same town, Mansfield, Ohio. And I think one of the things that, when I interviewed my father in prison in my film The Murder of Mansfield, like after this dramatic scene with my father, the pastor who he works for in the prison had said to me, prison turns men into babies, right? Because they're told what to do. Everything is done for them. And I almost feel after being incarcerated for so long, it's almost unfair to release someone who's 80, 81 into the world and saying, okay, good luck. There you go. When you've had everything catered for you, I think it's, obviously I think my father wants his freedom. So I'm sort of in this limbo with it because, you know, he served a long time. He's been denied parole twice, but many people think that it's not going to be a third time. But again, you're releasing someone out into the world that now it has to fend for themselves and has not had the experience because, you know, you don't get the privileges that maybe people imagine in prison that people get. And the world is a different place than when you stepped inside of there. Yeah. And I don't know. It's a real, you talk about cognitive dissonance. Mm. That's something that I struggle with every day with this type of situation, for sure.
So Collier, not to be a jerk here, but was that a yes or a no? You want him out?
That is a not sure at this time, and no comment. Mm. If I'm speaking to a journalist, I have no comment. And that was all on that round.
Yeah.
Because it would make a difference if Collier went up there and said, "I'm going to take my dad in and make sure he adjusts."
Yeah, that would not happen. And I also live in California. This is in Ohio, and so that would not happen. I am in no. Yeah. Despite maybe people's perceptions, the podcast is not this, money.
It's not a lucrative industry.
Yeah, nobody's Rink's truck does not pull up to my driveway every Tuesday afternoon and drop a pile of money in my driveway.
No, there's a labor of love. Speaking of labor of loves, though, I think one of the pieces that we'd be remiss to not articulate here is like, as we told this story, it became very evident that part of what instilled the conviction in these men were the women in their lives.
Mm. I was going to ask about outside influences.
Both Chewbacca and Derek get married in prison. They have wives who become incredibly dedicated to their innocence, to supporting them, to visiting them, to providing what they can provide for them. You know, I've always found it somewhat baffling. You know, like I would find it baffling both on both ends of the spectrum. Like, how do you work this? How does this make sense? And it's not as uncommon as I guess I would believe, but the women are a big part of this. They're a big part of this. We sat down with Derek's wife for an extended interview, and you start to understand how much of their lives they chose and elected to change in order to be present for someone who, you know, could not be present for them, and they literally couldn't lean on them. They could get emotional support from them, perhaps. But the vast majority of what their needs were, there were a lot of one-way elements of that relationship. A lot of one-way elements of the relationship. And that's just, in these kinds of stories, I think that gets lost. You know, part of what inspires you to get up every day, if you're Chewbacca or if you're Derek, is I want to get home because there's somebody who loves me, because there's somebody who wants to take care of me and I want to spend my life with. Part of it. And in fact, you know, one of the other, you know, in addition to the women who helped preserve, protect, and get these men home, another element of our story is the young women who were part of, you know, who were the witnesses often in these cases. And these were young women of color who were often found themselves in very difficult situations, and they were called to be witnesses, and they were harassed, and they had children that could have been separated from them, and they might have had a little bit of a record of their own. There's an element of manipulation of young people who are vulnerable, women in particular, that the system is very well conditioned to facilitate, at least at that time.
Absolutely.
So we have to bring those pieces to the story as well, because it helps us understand the collateral damage, you know, the impacts of the crimes, but also the collateral damage of a justice system that is so, so invested in a conviction that they will either use a witness or not use a witness, or manipulate or put somebody on the stand who doesn't belong there, who doesn't want to be there, somebody who wants to recant, but they won't let you recant because if you do so, then it can put your whole life in jeopardy. Like, all of these questions, these are 20-year-old people, 19-year-old people with two children, no job, and very little that they can cling to in their own lives. This is sordid stuff, you know.
And you were saying Scarsella was retired, and this is in like the 2010s when these cases started coming, and his past, you know, came back to haunt him. This is when this worked, but they had been working for decades, correct? And that's when they started gaining momentum. What was the big impetus for that momentum for them? That courts just started listening to them, or they got so many calls from the Daily News and the New York Post that these judges said, there must be something you can do with this. I mean, that's ingenious, by the way.
Well, you know, listen, the mood in the country has changed. The times have changed. The crime rate's gone down. You know, we have something called the Innocence Project. I mean, we understand now that innocent people were sent to prison. It's not a magical concept. It's not fantasy. It's so I think that the public became receptive to it. The politicians became receptive. And what we went back and looked at very specifically was the time at which it happened, 2012, 2013. And what this lands in the middle of is a race for the district attorney. There's a guy who is an older white man, 78 maybe, and he's been the district attorney for 24 years. So he's put all of these guys away, right? He's now running for a seventh term, sixth term. And he, and by the way, district attorneys, incumbent district attorneys do not lose in Brooklyn, but he's got a very particular challenger, a guy named Ken Thompson, who is a black man who has a childhood story that takes place in the projects, who's become an assistant U.S. attorney, very distinguished, but he really understands this issue, and he makes wrongful convictions a big issue in the campaign. So Charles Hines, the sitting district attorney, becomes very defensive, and he goes out and he, listen, to his credit, he starts saying, well, what did I do wrong? And he finds this one case, happens to be the case of a white guy, which he moves of his own accord David to Ranta. Overturn. David Ranta. Yeah, fascinatingly. So this was a big Scarsella case. Scarsella actually was on TV when he solved this case 20 years prior, kind of lionized as this was the great detective work of, you know, of the year. And fast forward 20 years and this work comes undone. But what happens then is because it's a political season is the sitting district attorney who's getting battered in the polls comes up and says, look, I'm investigating this myself. And I caught the bad guy. We've got one bad apple, this guy named Louis Scarsella. And I got him. Let's move on, right? And the Times, and in particular, this journalist that we profile is intrepid and fearless and somewhat over the top and has a film noir nickname. She's called Frenchie. But she kind of goes out and takes the information given to her by this prison law firm, runs with it and says, no, it's not just one case. We think there's a lot more allegations that need to be investigated. The challenger, Ken Thompson, this black man, runs with it and says, hey, you know, you can't play Captain America on one hand and then throw the say you're not responsible for what happened under your watch on the other. So it becomes a really interesting political turning point for the city. And Louis Scarsella becomes a campaign issue exactly at that moment.
Mm-hmm. That confluence is fascinating. And it's not lost in any way on the jailhouse lawyer, Shabaka in particular. He talks about it in many of his interviews, that it did require David Ranta, a white man, you know, to bring attention. So they very much perceive that there's a likelihood that it would not have been elevated and been the sort of public story that it became ultimately had it not been for the Ranta story. Because what Ranta does is open the pathway for them, and they know that. The moment Ranta happens, they're like, this is our moment. They know that they can create a wedge. They have a wedge, an opening. And they have this moment, and they shoot through that, and they use that, pardon, you know, the use of the metaphor, they glide through it. And it's significant. It's significant, again, because it goes back to the point, Kyle, you're like, this didn't just happen by happenstance. These guys didn't stumble their way out of prison. There was an element of calculation, coordination, and deep understanding, not only of the law, but political climate that they could seize upon and to utilize to their benefit. It is not, you know, one of the main things that happens, because at this point, once Ken Thompson is running, Derek is already out at this point in time on parole. Like he's already out. he's, you know, on a kind of, he's under supervision, but he's out and he's still got, you know, he has not at this point been exonerated, but he's been released. And what he does is he finds a way into Ken Thompson's campaign and says, hey, I'll be your guy and I can bring a lot of people with me, but I'm going to need you to get my back when the time comes. And this is a fearless person in this way. Derek is fearless. He's unafraid and unabashed about going to and sitting down with, you know, a political candidate and saying, I got the goods, but I'm not giving you the goods until you and unless you are going to work with me and help serve my interests as well. So there's a level of savvy on amongst all of these players and all of these characters that I think is just should not be looked upon as, this isn't just a simple conviction story of, you know, a wrongful conviction. This is a story of like, you know,
it's a fight for justice.
Fight for justice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what an incredible story. The podcast from Orbit Media is The Burden. And my guests today are Steve Fishman and Dax Devlin Ross. Gentlemen, this sounds like an incredible story. Where can our audience find the podcast?
Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts. And please follow us and leave a review. As you hear on podcasts, it really helps.
That it does. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to listening and binging the podcast. And congratulations on the feature from Apple and everything.
Thank you so much. All right, Collier. Great to hang with you.
This podcast is made possible by support from listeners just like you. For exclusive content around this podcast, please consider supporting me via Patreon by going to collierlandry.com/support. Please subscribe via Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from, and please leave us a 5-star review. If you want to see video episodes of this podcast, please check out my YouTube channel at youtube.com/collierlandry. You can find links to additional resources in the show notes of today's episode. This podcast is a production of Don't Touch My Radio, copyright Collier Landry.